Zane Lowe is dead.
A what?
Uxolotl lives.
Okay. I remember something about this.
Yes, some time ago. Not the real Zane Lowe. Virtual Zane Lowe is no more. Well, it's not. Let me explain.
please don't.
A while ago, about a year ago, I created some Python. We gave it a name, Virtual Zane Lowe, because it was designed to help me discover new music. And Martin named it that, I think, over coffee in the office.
Zane Lowe being a popular DJ on Radio 1 at some point.
Yes. Yes. Famous for discovering new music. He is the John Peel of his time, I see. I think.
And John Peel was?
A DJ before you were born, yes. And all it did was connect to my Spotify account using the API and use something called SpottyPy, which is a Python library, in order to manipulate a playlist. You've heard of all the discovery playlists and other playlists, mm-hmm. automatic playlists that these music providers have. I never found much success with those, so I thought, I know, I'll make my own. And it runs on a regular basis, finds new music, and gets rid of music from that playlist after a certain period of time, like 2 weeks. So that playlist is constantly changing. It's not that it's just filling up with new music. There is a limit and it cuts off and it only puts certain genres in there or things I think I'll like. And that's fine, but it only works for me. And I had a few people say to me, can I get that on my Spotify account? And I thought, well, that's a weird thing to ask. Why would you want to run Python like this that I've written on your Spotify account? And then I thought, actually, this might be possible. So I have turned it from some pretty shonky Python into some more shonky Python, but with a web front end on it, which is all like what all the cool kids do, having a Python back end and a web front end. And now it's accessible online. If you go to uxolotl.com, you can't use it, for reasons I will explain, but it's live and it works and it has a web front end.
So is your idea then that you will host this that other people can then use to connect to their account, as opposed to they have to run it themselves and the web interface is just a nice way for them to use it?
Basically, yes. It's I could give them like SSH access to my server and let them run the Python themselves. But that seems like a silly idea. So yes, what I wanted to do was give them a web page that they could log into. And by log in, what I mean is it bounces you through Spotify.
Yeah.
In order to get permission to use the API, the credentials are then cached, or the token is cached somehow. And on the back end, we use that token to connect to Spotify using the API and then manipulate that person's playlist. And so each person has a separate playlist in their account.
Mm-hmm.
So yours, if you were a Spotify user and you connected, yours would be different than mine, in theory, because the web UI gives you an opportunity to pick and choose which genres you want and which ones you don't want. And so you can kind of coerce algorithm, such as it is, by algorithm, I've already said it's some shonky Python at the moment, but yeah, it's a work in progress, but I'm actually quite pleased I've got this far. I managed to get over the hump of turning it from a thing that runs in a terminal on a server in my loft to something that runs in a terminal in a server in my loft with a web front end, which was quite a lot of work.
I think you're selling yourself short on the whole algorithm thing, because I think I'm user one in the system. You invited me to join and I can yes. access this thing. And you were talking through like ways to do the initial discovery. Like, what can you feed this tool to tell it something about your music preferences in addition to what you can see via the API, as in like most played genres and things. So I clicked on some buttons for the genres that I was most interested in. And it shoved a bunch of tracks in my, is it called Keepers and Sleepers and?
There's a Fresh Discovery.
Right, that's list. The one.
These names are open to be changed. But there are three playlists. The first one is the Fresh Discoveries. And that's the one that gets dynamically populated with songs. And the songs get removed.
Right.
And the keepers and sleepers, the keepers are the ones that it thinks, based on your listening preferences, that you like.
Right.
And so it will take them from the main list to the keepers list. And the sleepers are the ones you probably didn't like or maybe didn't even listen to. But they're in that sleepers archive, just in case you ever want to go back and have another look.
Yeah. So you created this UI where it makes like a word cloud of the genres that are associated with the artists you've listened to most. And when you hover over the word cloud and select them, it tells you which artists influenced that genre in your cloud. So I was like looking at, oh, this one is here because I have listened to Juliette Lewis. So I clicked on a bunch of these genres that I would have never have even guessed existed in the first place, let alone actively sought out. And in my fresh discoveries were a whole bunch of new songs, and I've now discovered two new artists. And this is without like me using it beyond the initial sign up and like picking out some genres from like what I like, apparently, it told me.
That's lovely to hear. I'm glad you found something new, because that was the goal, right? The whole purpose of this was, from my point of view, was to stop listening to the same music all the time and listen to some different music.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've given you access, so you are able to do this. And the reason why I say I gave you access is because the Spotify API limits me to 25 accounts that I can add to the back end to say, these are people who I would like to test this thing out. So while it's in development mode, there's only 25 people who can have access. One is me, one is you, and then whoever else I invite, which includes my kids and probably their friends who want to try this stuff out. But yeah, that's the state of it at the moment.
So when you say 25, this is through some sort of like dev program, is it, that Spotify operate?
So on Spotify, when you sign up to be a developer, lol, Spotify think I'm a developer.
You've got an API key, it's official.
Yes, exactly. So you create an app in their web page, for their developer web page. And in there, you fill in the various details, like the name of it, the description, the callback URL. So when they get bounced, the users get bounced through the login, where they end up after that. And you have to assign users to it. And you put in their first name, last name, and email address, which for people with a Spotify account, Spotify will know. Mm-hmm. And that way, you can track who's using it. Because it also has metrics, a very rudimentary metric screen that lets you see how many of those 25 users are actually using the service and which API calls you're making. And that's something I need to work on. There's a whole load of stuff that I haven't really talked about that I need to optimize the API calls, because they're quite strict on how many calls you can make over what period and like the volumes of data. I don't want it to run for ages, like grubbing around in lots of different songs, but I want it to be effective. Mm-hmm. And so I need to work on it a bit. It's not final in any way. It's just a prototype that now has a web front end, so other people can test it, not just me. And actually, having you test it uncovered something that I didn't even realize straight away as soon as you signed up, because you don't have a pro premium Spotify account, and I do. And I didn't realize it works for you even without Spotify premium, kind of surprised me. Yeah. But I realize actually it shouldn't surprise me, because they want you to listen to music and then listen to adverts and then get annoyed by the adverts and pay. And so anything that I'm doing that's making you listen to more music is surely only going to benefit them in the end. So they would want this to work, right?
Yeah. So I switched from Spotify to Apple Music, I don't know, a year or maybe 2 years ago now. So I've still got my Spotify account, but we don't pay for it anymore. And what I think we figured out was some of these like apps and things that use Spotify, you have to have a premium account, but they tend to be audio players. They actually play the music, whereas you're not doing that. What you're doing is manipulating playlists. So you only ever use the Spotify app in order to listen to the audio. So I get whatever adverts Spotify want me to hear as a result of listening to the music.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes it a lot simpler, because I'm only using the API that is manipulating the playlist. I'm not even trying to play. Yeah, you know, if you go to the website and you sign in, it won't let you actually play anything. It just shows you the onboarding experience and then later a dashboard and maybe fiddle with some buttons. But I don't plan to make it so that my thing can play the songs, because there's plenty of other Spotify players like NC Spot on the command line, which is available in the Snap Store. And then there's the official app, and then there's the web player, and then you can play in the car and you can play everywhere. So I don't need to do that bit. That's not the bit that's important for me.
Now, at the very beginning of this, you quickly mentioned what the name was and what it wasn't called anymore. It's an unusual name. Where did that come from?
So the original name, Virtual Zane Lowe, is the one that I'm not going to use anymore, partly because he's associated with Apple Music. I don't have his permission to use that name. The name is Auxolotl. And that is just a temporary name for the moment. I don't know whether that will stick. I might come up with a better name. But aux is, you know, as in the auxiliary port, and all the kids these days, they talk about, you know, having the aux, which means, can I play some music now? And so if you, you know, if a child unit says, pass me the aux, what they actually mean is, let me have the Bluetooth connection so that I can play some music. And so I thought Auxolotl. You know, it's a play on axolotl. Axolotl's a cute aux. I don't know whether that name will stick. And I don't know. It might not even work. It might be that other people say, no, it just finds loads of music I don't like, and this is no good. But that's why we test it. Yeah, it worked for me for a while. It might work for other people. We shall see.
Last episode, I was explaining to you how I've been learning Go and loving it, and how I'd written two utilities for us to produce MP3s and MP4s of the podcast. And I was using a tool called FFmpeg Go, which, if you remember, is a statically compiled small FFmpeg library and then Go bindings. Well, I've hard forked it, and I have created a project called FFmpeg Statigo.
I can't help but think you're not as good at naming things as I am.
What
really?
Do you mean?
You know, Statigo, I don't know. It's okay. What does it do?
Well, it does much of the same that FFmpeg Go does. So I think I mentioned last time that I left some issues on the project. They'd got an open issue about not being able to build for all of the different supported architectures. And since then, GitHub have got the mechanism to do that, and I offered to supply it, but it's been crickets, and I got the impression that maybe that project is moribund. So I hard forked it, and I've done several things to improve it, not least changing the name. And ordinarily, I wouldn't put like languagey or platformy things in the name, except for what I've noticed is in the Go ecosystem, you want Go in the name to immediately sort of label it so Go developers know this is a Go thing. So this is why you see a lot of RS and R-related stuff in the Rust ecosystem as well. So I'd usually go for something more clever, but I wanted to keep the Go thing. So FFmpeg Statigo it is.
I guess it's not a product, is it?
No.
It's a library, and it's okay.
Yeah.
It does what it says.
So the big changes are that FFmpeg Go used FFmpeg 6, and as it happens, I'm working on a third tool for us, which I'll get to at some future date. It's a little ways out yet. And that needed filters that have been introduced in newer versions of FFmpeg. So my first task was I uplifted FFmpeg to FFmpeg 7, and then 7.1, and then 8.0. And that in itself was non-trivial because the API has changed several times along the way. So I had to refactor some of the, not the Go bindings, they've got a tool which automatically generates the Go bindings, and I had to adapt that to some of the type changes in the API, in the FFmpeg API, in order to do it. So I'd got like a direct port, which was, it was FFmpeg 6, and now it's the latest, greatest FFmpeg 8. And then I discovered that in order to access some of these filters that I wanted to use and some of the resampling and scaling stuff that I wanted to use, those APIs hadn't been hooked up at all in the automatic generator. So I thought, oh, well, this is easy. You just point it at a bunch of the include files for FFmpeg and it will automatically generate them. And it started and then fell in pieces because there was all sorts of new types and things that it hadn't been trained on. So I had to uplift this binding generator that turns the C headers into the Go bindings. And that was about a week of evenings of work. But it's paid off significantly, because what that meant is that the original FFmpeg Go had about 27% coverage of the FFmpeg API. And FFmpeg Statigo has about 85% coverage of the FFmpeg API. And I can't actually get any further than that through automatic generation. Everything that's left, there's like not a direct, obvious type conversion that you can do automatically. There's all sorts of opaque pointers and things like this. So in some cases, I've had to manually create a few of the bindings to get to a few bits that I wanted, only about 7 or 8.
So you described there doing this FFmpeg update in incremental steps. Given that you knew that you wanted to end up on FFmpeg 8 because that had the feature you wanted, what was the advantage of doing it a step at a time rather than just dumping 8 in there and fixing everything at once?
It was small portions of breakage to fix along the way. So I'd looked at the API changes in FFmpeg and I knew that the first change was going to be fairly easy and the next one was going to be fairly easy and then it was going to be a big change and that was going to be nasty. So I thought I'd do it in increments and just sort of make it, because then you can see the progress. When you haven't got much time to work on stuff, if you've got like an hour, you can actually see yourself making progress as opposed to still being in a mess after an hour of effort.
Right.
So yeah, that was the reason. Yeah.
You're using this in Jive Fire and Jive, what's the other one?
Drop,
that's it. And those are quite good names. And I popped into the office this week and you were quite excited about the progress you've made on this. It's like, yeah, it sounds very dry, like updating libraries and bumping something to a new version. But there's a little bit more than that, isn't there?
So I've also added the full gamut of hardware acceleration to FFmpeg Statigo. So it supports on Linux NVENC for NVIDIA, QuickSync, which is Intel's acceleration platform, and VA API, which is sort of a long-standing Linux API for acceleration stuff. And that works on Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA stuff. And then in FFmpeg 8, or where they have added it over several versions, but there's now a full collection of Vulkan accelerated encoders and decoders. And then on macOS, it uses Video Toolbox.
So does this mean that people could develop new applications in Go that are hardware accelerated or maybe could replace applications which have calls out to an external FFmpeg binary, they could replace that with this like lean, tight, fast, hardware accelerated built-in library? Is that like the ultimate goal? I mean, obviously the ultimate goal was scratching your own itch with those two applications and more by the sound of it. But like other people might want to just replace an external call to FFmpeg.
Exactly that.
This has actually sparked my interest because I've spoken in the past about my auto handbrake tool I have for ripping DVD libraries, like lots of DVDs, and dumping the disc and then encoding each video. And this is making me think this could be a nice way of hooking into that encoding step rather than having to rely on the handbrake CLI. You could go directly to FFmpeg with all of the accelerated encoding bit, which is a bit tricky to hook up right with some of the handbrake CLI stuff. This might be a way to give more control and, by the sound of it, quite good performance.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things there. On the performance side, One of the things that FFmpeg Go didn't do is it didn't optimize any of the linking or compiling. So actually it was leaving a lot of performance on the table. So the audio encoding in FFmpeg Statigo is 215% faster than FFmpeg Go. And the software video encoding, if we just look at H.264, is 51% faster, and that's just compiler optimization. Now, what I've done in Jivefire, because one of the things that really irritates me is when I've written scripts in the past that wrap FFmpeg, you have all of this nasty conditional stuff about, if there's an NVIDIA GPU, use this thing, and la la la, and it drives me batty. So what I've done in Jivefire is it enumerates the hardware, and it automatically detects all of the available video hardware. It very quickly creates a context surface for all, or attempts to create a context surface for all of them, catches the errors, and then it knows which ones work. And then I've defined a list of, this is the best order, like, of outcomes in terms of quality and performance, and it will just pick the right hardware accelerated outcome for you. Now,
that's smart. I like that. Yeah. That's really cool.
I was very pleased with myself with that. Now, what's interesting is that I've written a whole bunch of optimized color space conversion stuff in Go for reasons. And curiously, the software encoder in FFmpeg Statigo is now faster than the VA API hardware accelerated encoder and the Vulkan encoder because the color space conversions are so, so fast now.
Okay. I don't really understand that, but that's clever anyway.
Yep. And then for Alan, it's got a tightly optimized version of OpenSSL in it, the very latest version of OpenSSL. And using some know-how from work, it's got all of the stuff you don't need turned off in OpenSSL, but it enables all of the streaming protocols that you need inside of FFmpeg, but with all of the TLS and SSL capability enabled. So
right.
I think I have a tool for you.
Yes. So that goes back to something I mentioned previously at the end of the episode where I said I was streaming, where I said I was looking at porting StreamSprout from Bash and FFmpeg to Go with something built in. And this could help tremendously with that.
Yeah. And what I've done is I've compiled out all of the codecs that you don't need.
Like DVD, so that'll affect Mark.
Actually, no, it's designed for Mark's use case because I do the same thing. So I sort of made a set of rules. In fact, I documented it, the codec inclusion policy, to sort of describe the workflows it's intended to support.
Has to fit Alan, Martin, and Mark's use case.
Yeah.
No other codecs.
Yeah, so all of that massive list of codecs that FFmpeg supports that are all sort of retro and legacy stuff, those are all disabled. And by turning those off, you save some space in the static FFmpeg library, and that budget, if you like, I've then used to turn on all of the hardware acceleration and OpenSSL and SRT and all of these modern things that we want in the tool.
Nice. Have you got it building on all platforms?
I have. It builds on Linux, ARM and AMD 64 and macOS, Apple Silicon and Intel. And it does that in CI, and it has a Nix dev shell in the project. So if you clone the repo and you just do a Nix develop, then you get all of the build dependency automatically provisioned.
Well, that's a weekend project coming up right there. Finally, where's the repo? Where can people find FFmpeg Statigo?
We have a GitHub organization. So github.com/LinuxMatters/FFmpeg-Statigo. Link in the show notes.
I have been experiencing a bug on the Ubuntu desktop on my work ThinkPad, and I haven't fixed the bug, but trying to diagnose the bug led me to a new discovery.
Another bug? That's usually the way. It's three bugs deep, and then you get there.
So the issue that I've been having, and some of my colleagues have been having as well, because we all have ThinkPads and use the GNOME desktop on Ubuntu, is that we find ourselves typing in one app, and then we'll open another app and click a link and that link will open in Firefox, and then you'll be on the page in Firefox and you'll start typing, but the caret is still in the original app you were typing in, and you end up typing in that app instead. Yes. So this can be a bit hairy if you were, for instance, in a chat with someone and you'd start typing something which you think is going into a web page that they can't see. But fortunately, I've not had anything too embarrassing happen as a result yet.
Yeah. Or you've tapped a YubiKey.
So you're saying the focus doesn't switch. Is it the app switches, but the focus doesn't come with it? Or
the
something?
Focus switches, but the typing caret stays in the input on another app. So the mouse focus follows, the window is in the foreground, but you're typing somewhere else.
That's a horrible bug. Yeah. Is it on an LTS?
Yes. It's in Launchpad. So I have been discussing this in Launchpad and trying to offer some sort of useful thing, because it doesn't happen all the time. So it's tricky to, you know, diagnose and give reproduction steps for. But while I was trying to investigate this, one of the things was suggested was, which GNOME extensions do you have installed? So I thought, well, I'll try disabling all of my extensions and I will gradually enable them one at a time and see when it starts happening. And I still haven't nailed it down. But while I was going through my list of extensions, I've spoken previously on the show, I believe, about gtile, which is the tiling extension I use for laying out my windows. And I noticed that in the system extensions section of the extensions manager, which is the stuff that comes with Ubuntu rather than the stuff you install yourself, there is an extension I hadn't noticed before called the Ubuntu Tiling Assistant.
I did not know that was there either.
Huh. Yes. Is that shipped by default now?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I thought, I wonder what that does. I'll have to give it a go. And I had a look, and it fits my use case for tiling absolutely spot on. So the thing that I have with all of the tiling extensions and apps that I found for Ubuntu is a lot of them assume that you have a wide monitor and you want to put windows side by side or in columns. Gtile was okay because I could faff around with the layout enough that it worked for my vertical monitor. But the Ubuntu Tiling Assistant will do side by side, in corners, or top and bottom. It's not customizable, but top and bottom and in the corners are all I need for my my tiling purposes.
Is this anything, aside from the solution you have, or the workaround you have, the Tiling Assistant, is this anything to do with the thing in GNOME that people have been long frustrated by, where it pops up a notification and tells you when an application has been launched and is ready for input? That thing that's trying to stop you accidentally typing in the wrong window. Is it that? And have you disabled that, or has that been tweaked in some way?
That's a good question. It could be related to that. I did at some point have an extension to stop that happening, but that had always worked, as in it would foreground the window and let me start using it, as opposed to leaving my cursor behind. So yes, I'm not sure now that it was, yeah, if it was that, or I don't think it was gtile. You know, I've now stopped using gtile, but I don't think gtile was responsible, because that was the thing I thought was probably doing the most in terms of window switching and listening to keys I'm pressing and things like that. So I did have my suspicions that was it. But yeah, I haven't stopped it happening yet.
It's tricky because you said you don't have a set of steps to easily reproduce it for the Launchpad bug. So
no, I mean, I know which steps reproduce it, but I can't get it to happen on demand.
Ah.
It'll happen and I think, oh yes, I just clicked a link in Thunderbird and it opened in Firefox and I'm still typing in Element. But I can't, it's not only when I click in Thunderbird, and it's not always when I click in Thunderbird.
I wonder if it's manifest. I've had this kind of thing happen where you can't reproduce it manually because you don't go at the same speed when you're trying to reproduce it manually. When you're working and you're going click, 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 press, click, 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 and type, your brain is a couple of steps ahead and you start typing before the window, like the window's like 100% painted. And I wonder if you're only seeing it during day-to-day activity because you're going at 100 miles an hour, whereas when you're trying to reproduce it, you're going slower as you're methodically trying to reproduce it. I don't know.
Reproduce it really quickly. Catch it out.
Yeah. Look away, or like don't let it see you looking, or something like that. That would do it. Yeah, turn off the webcam.
Now, I say this as someone has fully embraced Wayland, but I am going to guess that if you log into the X session, this doesn't happen, and it's a Wayland issue.
I thought that, and so I checked, and I was already in the X session.
Oh, damn it. Okay. It's an X problem, then.
Yes, it's totally right. Yeah. Contrary to Martin's assertion, I think this is absolutely an X org thing, and it's a good thing that that's dying, and you should switch to Wayland. Yes.
Does it happen in both?
That's a good question. See, I have other problems in Wayland, which meant I've been sticking with X for now. But I do want to see if I can resolve those problems and then see if it resolves this problem. So that's probably the next on my list for a long-term solution because, I really need to jump before I'm pushed on that one anyway. But my general woes aside, two thumbs up for Ubuntu Tiling Assistant. And if you're on Ubuntu and you want to use it, you've already got it. So just turn it on.